So thank you, François, for this invitation and the pleasure to be here at the Collège de France. I came out of the previous session with not a confused mind, but a realization that this issue of poverty measurement are quite complex. And I'm afraid I have to apologize first by saying that I am going to complicate them further. Because you see, in a sense, when Stephen Classen is saying that multi-poverty measurement, multidimensional, sorry, measurement of poverty is very important, I totally agree. But what I'm going to argue is that there are key dimensions that are missing, and that you know, it's probably very difficult to integrate them in such an index anyway. In a sense, you know, I want to start with the concept of Amartya Sen. What do you mean by progress? What do you mean by development? It's not only a question of well-being, even material well-being, but you know, it goes beyond two dimensions that include its emancipation. It's enlarging the space of freedom of the people. Okay, let's put it this way. And we know that social norms may be malevolent in the sense that they may prevent this emancipation of the people. They may prevent people from realizing their capability. And unfortunately, they can persist for a long time. Just let me take you an example. The first one is food binding in China. It lasted 1,000 years, was suppressed only in the revolution of 1910-1911. Beginning at about age 6 to 8, the female child's 4 smaller toes were bent under the foot, the sole was forced to the heel, and then the foot was wrapped in a tight bandage day and night in order to mold a bowed and pointed 4-inch-long appendage. Foot binding was extremely painful in the first 6 to 10 years of formative treatment. Complications include ulcerations, paralysis, gangrene, and mortification of the lower limbs. Perhaps 10% of girls did not survive the treatment. This was started in the Song dynasty, completely generalized under the Ming in 17th century and lasted till 20th century. Now, the origin we know was a way of enforcing imperial males' exclusive sexual access to his female concerns. Now, another one is female genital cutting, which includes clitoridectomy, excision, and fibrillation. It originates in slave trading geared toward the market of Egypt and Arabia quite a long time ago, in fact, in pre-Islamic times. And when you look at the figure, it's about, latest estimate, 100 million girls, especially in Africa, that are still suffering from female genital cutting. There are 12 countries with a rate of prevalence exceeding 50%, and 5 countries with rate of prevalence exceeding 90%, and 2 countries, Egypt and Somalia, with rate 97-98%. So this is an immense problem. And you know, when, for instance, in Senegal, I'm going to the experience of Senegal time and again in this talk, uncut women can be insulted, labed solema, meaning rude, ignorant, immature, uncivilized, and unclean. They are reputed or known to be known, or deemed to be knowing nothing, and may not be allowed to serve water or even food to men and their husbands. Okay, so now the question is, how do you get rid of those? And you know, economists are used to focus their attention on emergence of new economic opportunities, a cause of economic mobility, reduce poverty, increase income. And so a point could be made, look, maybe new economic opportunities is the solution. It can have broader beneficial effect than just reducing poverty, increasing income. It can also help in the social and cultural emancipation of disadvantaged groups. And this is exactly the issue that I want to address in this talk. And you will see that there is no conclusive answer to this question. So if that were true, this trickle-down view of emancipation, you could say then it's good because economic growth, understood as the rise of economic opportunities, would give rise to multidimensional progress. Of course, the qualification that we need is that these new opportunities must be geared towards the people who need it, towards the people who are vulnerable in the sense that they suffer from the social norm that I have mentioned. Okay, so let's take that point. Then the point can be made with a simple bargaining framework that outside, since new economic opportunities can be conceived as new outside opportunities or exit opportunity, they should improve the situation of the vulnerable people. Now, let's assume, to make things clear, a simple rival claimants game of the type that is written here, and that that means or that implies that the game is conflictual or that the social norm is conflictual. This is a widow. She's just been a widow, and the whole question is, can she keep the land of her husband? But no, as often in Africa, in-laws can pretend or can argue that the land should come back to them. So I'm now addressing this issue of land inheritance in a sense with this example. And so, you know, it's in a sense, either the widow forfeits and she gets nothing, and the whole inheritance, let's say, this is the amount of land A, goes to the in-laws, or this is the opposite. And if they both claim it, they have a cost, and this cost can be asymmetric, and you can imagine that the cost for the widow is greater than for the in-laws. Okay, hope. Okay. No, just think of a simple bargaining game. Think of the custom corresponding to the outcome of a bargaining game, and the outside opportunities serve as a threat point. If the change in outside opportunities improve the weak party lot, in this case the widow, by raising her utility from the threat point, you can say, good, the result of the bargaining will improve, and so the custom will change. Now, let me talk about a more sophisticated framework that I have developed with several people, including with Zaki Wahaj, in which, in fact, we conceive that there is an agent whose objecting function is made explicit that is, in fact, deciding about the custom. So how does it work? The weaker party, let's say the woman in this case, I think we can focus on the gender problem, may appeal to the formal court, which enforces a law that is progressive, that is a law in favor of women. But the weaker party may also choose to leave the community and take up the outside opportunity, if she has, and thereby she escaped the custom, right? No, on the other hand, you have what we call the customary authority, let's say the council of elders in the village. They are confronted with a trade-off. They have their own preference about what the custom ought to be. We call it this preferred judgment. And departing from that preferred judgment involves a cost. And increasingly so as they go further and further away from their preferred judgment. But on the other hand, their social prestige and their power depend on the size of their jurisdictional domain. So if everybody leaves and nobody comes to them, I mean, their power is just vanishing, and they want still to have control over as large a group as possible. Now, this customary authority has two ways of discouraging weaker people from appealing to a more favorable law that, for instance, the central state has enacted. They can threaten the weak party with social exclusion, a repressive tactic, but they can also adapt the custom so as to make it more attractive and acceptable for the vulnerable category to stay within the community and therefore under the jurisdiction of the customary authority. Now, this customary authority, this is a dynamic game, is forward-looking, which means that it properly anticipates that if the customary law is unfavorable to some community group members, this may leave, the community and, for instance, migrate to a city, even before they are involved in a dispute. And similarly, if they expect economic opportunities outside of the community to improve in the near future, the customary authority in this dynamic, forward-looking kind of game, they should opt to make the custom more progressive. So the idea here is that outside economic opportunities and expectations regarding future change in them influence the evolutionary path of the custom. Now, the sequence of the event in the game is like this. First, there is a stochastic variable that represents the current state of the economy, so a shock in the outside opportunities can be conceived as one of the source of comparative static result. Second thing, the customary authority declares a custom. Then each player decides whether they remain in the community or migrate, leave the community. And then they discover in the next step whether they have been embroiled in a dispute, let's say a land dispute with their family or their in-laws. Now, for each dispute, the customary authority gives the verdict which corresponds to the custom that has been declared in the beginning of the game. All of the disputes are settled in the formal court. Now, for disputes settled by the customary authority, disputants may decide whether they accept the verdict or not. If they don't accept it, they go to the formal court. If they accept, they stay within the community. But if there is an appeal to the formal court, they are punished, let's say by social exclusion or whatever you can think, we call this P, by the customary authority. Now, the central result that we have working with this kind of framework is that an improvement of outside opportunities can induce the custom to evolve in the direction of the formal law, which is by definition more favorable to the disadvantaged group, in this case, the women. Now, since community members are assumed to be heterogeneous in their outside opportunities, if the economy is such that there are good outside economic opportunities prospects, those with the best outside opportunity leave the community and will be under the rule of the formal law, and those who stay, those who have the weaker outside opportunity, remain within the jurisdiction, normally, of the customary authority, but the custom has evolved in their favor, so they are better off. And if the conflict is severe enough, because we also endogenize the severity of the conflict, they can even appeal to the formal court. So we have a situation of legal dualism. Some go to the formal court, a minority, but the customary law is actively used still by the population. Now, if the outside opportunities improve, the bargaining strength of the weak party, this is the main point that we are making, increases, and the customary authority responds by adjusting the custom because it is keen as to keep within its jurisdiction as many people as possible. Yet we also show, and keep that in mind for the remaining part of my talk, that there are conditions under which this magnet effect does not operate. And one of these conditions is when the customary authority is highly reluctant to deviate from its preferred judgment, whatever the outcome of that. Now, what are the examples that illustrate that this bargaining argument is, you know, essentially has relevance? For instance, the enhanced rights of women to initiate divorce in sub-Saharan Africa, including in Muslim countries, which is a massive change in Africa today. That you see that many separations or divorce are now initiated by women, whereas it was unthinkable, at least in the patriarchal societies before. So that shows that Africa is moving quickly in some respect, and certainly a good example of that. Growing incidence of love versus arranged marriage in African and Asian society. Also something that is quickly spreading, and you can say this is enlarging the space of freedom of the people, this progress, you know, it's not only income, but this is a result of the outside opportunities. Yet, unfortunately, counterexamples exist, and female genital mutilation, as I quote in the beginning, is one of them, and honor crimes in tribal societies is another one. Okay, now, what I would like to know is, I want to understand why the trickle-down qualified story, in the sense that if you improve outside economic opportunities geared toward the people who are vulnerable, it may not have an effect, like in the case of female genital mutilation. Why is it? What is wrong in the model? You know, this is kind of, how can we think that in terms of theory? Now, the first thing is that I had qualified the theory by saying that there are conditions under which, in fact, the custom will not move. And this is the case when the customary authority is very rigid, very reluctant to depart from the preferred judgment. Example, Ghana. If you take the PNDC law, which tried to change the law of inheritance, the practice of inheritance in the Ghanaian countryside, by trying to make the spouse and the children inherit rather than the matriclan, you see that the magnet effect is exactly operated, in the sense that the custom has gradually evolved toward the law, does not coincide with the law, it went evolving in the direction of the law, except in the northern part of the country. Why? Because in the northern part of the country, you have Muslim groups and customary authorities say, this is going against Islam, and so there's out of question to change anything, and there, nothing has happened. So this is a kind of failure that can happen even within the framework of the model that we were using. A second possibility is what Vijayendra Rao has called constraining preference. Members of the victimized group internalize the value and the norms of the dominant group so that, in fact, there is a subjective game that does not coincide with the objective game, the rival claimants game. In fact, in Senegal, recent studies have shown that men are more supportive of the law banning female genital mutilation than women themselves. In the beginning, it was, oh, that's the man, you know, it's the interest, and in the origin it was. But no, in fact, the support of the practice comes more from women than from men. So that's another possibility. Now, let's think about yet another possibility, which is to say, look, maybe your game is not the right one. And the game is a social coordination game. And so the social norm is not a social convention, which means an outcome that is well established when people's expectations converge and their actions are there coordinated. And the social equilibrium, is socially inefficient. Okay? So everyone dislikes the norm, we don't like it, but since we all expect that the others will do it, and there is a kind of decentralized punishment mechanism, this pessimistic expectation support a practice that nobody likes. You know, we know since Akerlof and Timur Kuran and other people that this is quite possible. Okay, but then, you know, the question is that if there are people seizing outside opportunities in the way I was explaining in the beginning, you would expect that through a kind of evolutionary stochastic process, the member with the best outside opportunity could trigger a bandwagon effect. Since everybody dislikes the norm, you know, this is not a very stable equilibrium, and the norm should collapse rather quickly under the effect of, let's say, some people announcing that. A beautiful example is the practice of honor crimes. Take it from a small city near Hebron in Palestine called Surif. There, a girl was murdered by her uncle because she talked to a man who in fact wanted to marry her, and she was studying at university. And her body was discovered in a well 1 year later, in fact. And then, you know, suddenly there was the brother of that assassinated girl who took up an action, was highly educated, was living in a city, came back and created a movement of denouncing the leniency of the law of the Palestinian Authority against honor crimes. And the whole village then followed. And massive demonstration happened in Surif, then in Hebron. And the Palestinian Authority, which had always refused to change that law, and because they are dominated by big patriarchal family, then suddenly changing. So that's an example that shows, yes, this is credible, this can happen, even with that kind of game. And in fact, since everyone dislikes the norm, you are not surprised. No, another solution is try to find a way to coordinate. It should go quickly and simply. That's what Tostan did in Senegal. Tostan had this idea, let's go to the community, let's talk to the women and the men, let's show them and explain to them why it is dangerous for your health, for the health of these girls, that they are cut. We do that, and the whole process of conscientization, education, etc., going through the villages, end up in what they call a public declaration. A public declaration is a moment where all villages are meet together, or at least their representative authorities, and they declare publicly in front of the population and the other village, etc., that they give up the practice of female genital mutilation. They had 103 public declarations. Okay, my student Julia Camiotti, who studied the process that ensued in this village, show that there is zero impact. And that all what has been advertised by Tostan, according to which they had a big impact, for which they got the Hillary Clinton Press Prize and the prize of the best NGO in the world, etc., we have found that, in fact, there is no impact. And so the question is, so of course you mean, but what do you mean, this public declaration? Well, you ask the people, they say, you know, we got a ticket, a big feast, a good meal. We go, they ask us to say that, we say it. But there was no genuine commitment behind this this statement. Now then, why does the norm persist in this case? Then you have to think, maybe this is not the right game or the right equilibrium that I have described. Let's now assume that you have a coordination game, but you are in the socially efficient equilibrium. Everybody likes the custom. And so, expecting that everybody follow the custom, they just do it, so it's Pareto efficient in that sense. No, this would explain why members who have seized upon outside opportunity, if for instance, even through migration to advanced economies, stick to the practice. After all, cutting, as you know, in France, Belgium, Spain, etc., is continued as a practice even by migrants. So they had outside opportunity, they still stick to the practice. So you may say, but they agree with the practice. Yes, it's true, migrants often remain part of the local culture and arrange marriages that are, in fact, practice with the local villages to which they return during the holiday time is, of course, an element in this. Now, a variant would be this one. Members who seize outside opportunity undergo a change in their preference. They know dislike, let's say, female genital mutilation, but they are unable to change those of the other members who have stayed in the community because they have weaker outside opportunities. Now, the problem now is that often they are unable to change the practice in their village. Why? Because they may be perceived as renegades. Why? Because they're seen as upholders of a foreign culture that threatens local culture and identities. In Senegal, for instance, the fear is expressed as the risk of westernization, or in the Fulani societies or the Tukula society of the River Valley, as a risk of Wolofization, which means the Wolof who do not practice genital mutilation are going to dominate us. They impose their own culture on us. This is unacceptable. So what is the lesson from that? Female genital mutilation is regarded as a cultural trait, as a symbolic aspect of a traditional culture that stands on its own in the face of outside influence and pressure. And any outside attempt to eradicate the practice is perceived as an act of cultural aggression. Okay, now, laws that ban, for instance, female genital mutilation are seen immediately because they are felt to be imposed, generating cultural resistance, and statesmen like, they want us to be like them, or we will not let our culture be destroyed, are often heard in the communities that resist. Now, interestingly, when the law was voted in Senegal in 1999, Momar Law, who introduced it to parliament, made a statement saying that no one is really going to go to jail and the government will ensure that courts do not apply the law. You know, it's just there, a kind of symbolic thing. But don't worry, you know, we all know that you're very keen to keep your practice. The government will not go after you. No, still the question is, why is it that such traditional practices as arranged marriage quickly disappear, whereas others such as honor crimes, early girl marriages, and female genital mutilation persist? No, a tentative answer is the following. I don't say the full answer, but I find it says something interesting. That in the case of arranged marriage, for instance, or in the other case, that the right to initiate divorce or whatever, you know, the practice has not been criminalized or proscribed by any law. So law of marriage, for instance, are not viewed as an outright attack on the local culture. And in fact, law of marriage gets gradually established because also, and I'll come back to that, the elders can save their faith because children still consult with them and say, look, this is my love, I want to marry that girl, but we really keen that you parents approve of it. And you know, when you talk with the parents, they say, what can we do? You know, they will do it anyway. And they may leave the village if we don't agree. So we said yes. And so we maintain all the ritual of the traditional marriage as though it was arranged. Okay, so it means that a signaling role of criminal law exists in the sense that they convey the idea that the indicted behavior is seen as bad in Western eyes. And that's what generates, in fact, antagonism. So in a sense, you know, we depart, this view departs from the last paper of Benabou and Tirole on laws and norms, who tend to see that also the law has a signaling effect, but in the sense that it says something about the belief of the society. And since the legislator doesn't know with perfect, you know, doesn't have perfect information about exactly to what extent he does it, there is an interesting issue that arises. But essentially, they see the signaling function of the law as saying something about the norms and the preferences of their own people. Here we are saying something opposite. We are saying the law is saying something about what this guy there at Washington, Brussels, or Paris want, because they feel that we are uncivilized if we don't do it. Okay, now, and that's my last comment and reflection, is that in traditional universe, because you could say, but then, you know, it may be the case that for some norms, as you have shown, some norms may evolve quickly and some got stuck, you know, they won't move. You know, in fact, the reflection I want to make now is the following, that in traditional universe, change is possible, but only through blending or accommodation. So that local culture, which are perceived as legacy worth preserving, do not appear to be undermined. So this is the way you go about that. You know, it's like religious conversion. Of course, religious conversion is possible, for instance, in Africa. Why? Because, you know, it's all conceived in the world of spirits. You know, you have a spirit that comes from another religion than the spirits that we have in our traditional society. But still, it is the world of spirit. And maybe your spirit is even more powerful than ours, so we accept that you convert. So as soon as you can frame the change in a mental universe that makes sense for the people, the change may go through. But if it is perceived as a frontal attack on your culture, people immediately resist for this identity cultural reason. Okay, so attempt to impose radical change from without are likely to create perverse effect, and one of these perverse effect is rigidification and puritanization of culture as a result of victimization feelings. Another possibility, people go into hiding, and for instance, one of the basic results of Kamioti is that the reaction to the law banning female genital mutilation is that people do it earlier because they feel for various reasons that if they do it on younger girls, in fact, they can hide it from the society. So they have de-ritualized the ceremony, they've removed the ceremony of female genital mutilation, because then everybody knows. So now there is the threat of the law, there is the threat of all these NGOs working and saying we should drop it, it's a bad practice, etc. So we do it secretly, privately at home when the girl is younger. It's very bad because for medical reasons that are obvious, the risk for the girls is higher when it is done too quickly. That's a perverse effect. And you know, in a sense, many African leaders know quite well that it's of no avail to impose this law, as I have shown with this Mama Law thing. For instance, you look at the law against polygamy in Gabon and Senegal. They're quite lenient, in a sense. You know, they're a law for exception. And if only, you know, in the beginning, if you want to be monogamous, then write it down. And then you have to stick to your commitment. But even that was not enough. There were too many people violating the law. So they say, okay, but then you have to write down clearly that you want to get out of it. And so in the end, you say, but you know, the change is not that big after all. Okay, I had another example of a radical approach. Maybe Danny Roderick will have comments to make. Is the Young Turks and Kemalist approach in Turkey was clearly a radical way, radical approach, and it's today that we measure the backlash. They wanted a cultural revolution in which not only the high Islamic civilization would be exchanged for that of Europe, but also the law and popular culture would be affected and would be transformed. So there was no attempt to harmonize European civilization, considered indivisible, with the Turkish culture. And so they advocate the closure of madrasa, of the tekkes and zaviyes, the Sufi lodges that are so important in the popular culture. They ban vows to Muslim saints. They replace the fez with a new national hat. They prohibit the veiling of unmarried women, especially during the education. They ban the wearing of the turban and the cloak, and they totally transform the Turkish legal system, and thereby alienated a large part of the population, which was still profoundly immersed in traditional Muslim culture. So this is, maybe I can just keep it there by this nice example about how blending is possible, provided you find the right way to save the appearance. In Ghana, southern Ghana, the practice of payment, marriage payments, has been kind of relaxed tremendously, so that a girl who finds a boy who has no money to pay the bride price to the girl's family. But still, you know, this is creating a problem because the tradition wants this to be paid. And in some villages, I have discovered that what happens is the following, that the ceremony takes place as usual. And the boy father comes and presents a check with the amount of money that is to be paid. That's the amount of the bride price. And then the father of the girl takes the check and behind his back tear it away, because he knows the guy cannot pay. But in front of the people, the appearances have been safe, and still, you know, that permits the norm to be changing. That's it.